We're here for a Tailwind nutrition tip from Ian Torrance. Ian Torrance, as you know, is a ultra runner of ultra runners. He has over 150 ultra runs. He is a coach. You can find him at mcmillanrunning.com if you want to have him coach you to your next victory. He's also started a race, Flagstaff to the Grand Canyon. It's a 100-mile run with a relay option for those of you that want a taste of what it feels like to get in the middle of a 100-mile run, and you're working towards that as your goal. Sign up as a relay. Ian Torrance, you have a tip for us from Tailwind Nutrition. What do you have?
Yes. How about getting lost?
Yeah.
I mean, we try not to do that, but eventually, especially the more you do trail races, you're going to find yourself on that end of the stick.
Oh, lost. Yeah.
Or off course, maybe not lost, but just you've lost the course markings or the trail you're on has disappeared. And it's probably next to, we were just talking about your stomach going south. It's probably the second worst feeling on race day if you find yourself off course, I think.
You'll definitely feel it in your stomach when you realize that you may be on a trail to nowhere.
Yeah, and I think it's important. I think there's some things you can do when this happens. I think, you know, not panicking and not getting angry is important. I think you're going to need that energy in the following hours. You're going to have to get yourself back on course, and then you're going to find yourself maybe off pace of what, depending on how long you've been lost, off your projected times for the event. I think carrying a course map is a good idea. However, there are a lot of people that maybe don't know how to use a topographic map or a course map. So I think it's important beforehand to familiarize yourself with the course, you know, read blogs, read the course website, just pay attention to key landmarks out there, turns, climbs, descents, know the distances between aid stations.
Yeah, that's a key point. The GPSs that are out there today are good tools to make sure that you haven't gone right or left, you know, when you should be going straight, so that you can make sure that you've hit that next aid station.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes we lose those GPS signals. Like, cell phones don't always work in some races, too, and you can lose GPS signals. So I always think paper maps are good, and or just a realization of, like, what the course does overall, having a broad idea of what the course is doing and what kind of landmarks it passes. And if it's only 3 miles to the next aid station, kind of know what your pace is like, or have an idea of how long it'll take you to get there. And if for some reason you've been going and going and going, you're like, I should have been there by now, knowing that you've done something wrong and you need to go fix that.
Okay, Ian, let's pick up at the point where you have this feeling that you're lost. You haven't seen a ribbon in you know, for a while, or a, yep, you know, a glow stick or something, and you feel like you're lost. What's your advice? What do you do at that point?
The first thing that you do is not leave the trail or the road that you're on. So you don't want to, even if you think you see someone across the canyon or on the mountainside, you don't want to take a cross-country route to try to shortcut back to the course. So don't leave the tread that you're on. So best thing to do is retrace your steps.
Good.
Follow your footprints back the way you came until you find those course markings or find another runner. Because two is always better than one. But yeah, you don't want to, you know, you can find yourself in a mess terrain-wise, vegetation-wise. You'll probably end up more lost, and it'll be harder for someone to find you.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think I've been lost many times, but still on the trail, just feeling like, hey, you know, I've been looking straight down and looking what I'm about to trip on, and so I don't see the ribbons and the markings. But I start watching, and then, oh, I see a ribbon. I'm so happy. It's like the greatest sight in the world. There's nothing more beautiful than a ribbon hanging there when you think that just maybe you're off course. And that's a nice feeling. So how many times have I been lost? Well, not too many, but how many times did I think that I've been lost? a lot of times. And so it's nice to just to have some confidence in the race directors and that they put some markings out there and just move forward and look to find that marker.
Yeah, and it's important to note also that people do screw around with course markings. People think that's a funny thing to do, and if that happens, things can go really crazy if that's the case. That's happened at a lot of races before. It happened last September at a race I was running in Moab. It's happened at Waldo. People like to take the course markings down, maybe put it down another trail. I think the important thing is knowing, okay, you've gone this far without seeing a marking or without hitting the aid station, and knowing, okay, I got to turn around. Just don't keep running and running and running and running. Just should know that the marking's out there, especially if early in the race the marking's pretty consistent.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's important. And then also never assume that the runner in front of you is going the right way too. So don't, you know, do your due diligence and look for turns and course markings yourself. Don't rely on the back of the person in front of you to lead you the right way.
Yeah, good point. And you know, many times the race director at the beginning of the race will say, we put a marker every quarter mile or every half mile or something, or every, you know, they'll give you some, and you'll be able to watch and get a rhythm of how often they come up. Obviously, there are different crews that mark different, you know, portions of the race. You can't ask somebody to mark a whole 50 miles or whatever it might be. They break the work up, but you'll get a rhythm of when the markings come up. So when you stop seeing that rhythm, then you know that there might be an issue.
Yeah, now, and when you get back on course, you've retraced your steps, you found the course markings, you found the turn that you missed. Don't try to make up lost time. That can end the race really quickly if you just, like, just go haywire with your pace and try to catch up to the people that you were running with before. That never works. You should just fall back into your goal race pace and keep a level head and keep moving forward. And you know, you can always come back to the race next year and do better, knowing that, you know, especially if you got lost for an hour, that you can come back next year and make that hour up. And yeah, the race will be there, and you just need to not, you know, reevaluate your goals now that you got off course. But don't get frustrated. Still continue forward. Go for the finish.
Well, great tip. You know, that part of ultra running is navigation, and that's part of the race. And as all things can go sideways on you, including a stomach, like you mentioned, maybe a blister that you've never had, a course marking can be one of those events. And in the end, it makes for a good story. And when we go out on trail runs, that's what we like to tell is stories. You always tell the good stuff and you know, the things that happen to you on a race, not necessarily all the victories and the, it felt great running through this section, I felt like I could run forever. You usually tell the parts of the story that, man, my stomach was gone, I was lost, I had this blister. That's the trail discussion. So that's part of the fun. So
that's right.
Ian Torrence, we appreciate you coming on and giving us a Tailwind tip. Folks, check out some Tailwind. It's we have experimented with it, with the orange, the organic lemon, the berry, the naked. All of it seems to work so good with not only the calories, 100 calories per scoop, but it also contains electrolytes. And I have run last few seasons with fewer electrolyte tabs and just taking the Tailwind in. It's not sweet tasting, but it gives you the calories and is well balanced in electrolytes. So it's been a good add for me and a lot of the other runners that we know through here at Trail Runner Nation and just our community of runners. So go take the Tailwind Challenge. Go to their website at tailwindnutrition.com and go out and run. Mas.
And today's Petzl running strategy is from our good friend Victor Ballesteros from victorysportdesign.com. Victor, thanks for joining us. What's your running strategy today?
Running strategy. Well, we should maybe think about the things that you should prepare going into a race, things that you should put in your drop bag, perhaps.
Ah, good strategy.
Well, and that relates to the drop bags that you have created, Victor. You have designed a bag that has places and pouches and things specifically for the ultra runner. True?
So to really organize yourself. Actually, beyond ultra running, you know, just something that is going to organize yourself so that, you know, if you're using it for an ultra, once you show up at the aid station, there's no searching for things. You know where everything is, you get it, and you get out. I mean, that's a kind of our little tagline motto, get in, get out, get moving. Mm. So things that I would probably think about and prep, number one mostly is nutrition, making sure I've got all my particular nutrition. There's a lot of stuff that just happens to be at races and aid stations that I don't take or I can't because it doesn't work for me. So I always make sure that I've got the things that I've been running with, working with, that I know are going to get me through the event. Those things are always in there. To make sure I've got space so that I could get rid of some things like gloves, sleeves, I tend to be rather minimal, so I think like my most important prep items are my nutrition and knowing where stuff that I'm either going to get rid of or pick up if it's going to be a headlamp, if it's going to be a longer event, make sure I've got all that stuff in there, make sure I got fresh batteries. I don't know. What other stuff do you guys
know? I was going to say, I think that you hit a point that is good prep, and that is to find out what aid station items are going to be on the table at a particular race. Most race directors will say on their website what products they're going to have there, and you will know whether it's something that works for you or doesn't. And if it doesn't, then that's something you need to prep for to have in your drop bags.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll add to that is that a lot of these runs that we're doing, they're maybe in the spring or the fall, and they may be in the mountains, which this now applies to just any time of the year. See, things change, conditions change. And one thing that's very comforting is to know that I have some sleeves or a light jacket or gloves or something to put over my ears. Something in those drop bags become really a peace of mind and a comfort, and what becomes very challenging to make it through some of the ultras can be eased quite a bit by having your stuff that you're looking towards.
Exactly. And also, I think it's kind of a good practice to try and get into, which is to really think about what you're going to need and don't overpack. A lot of times people overpack, and all that does is just create more stuff that you have to deal with when you're trying to find the things that you actually truly need. And I know that it's difficult sometimes because, you want to be prepared if it's going to be colder, so you want to have jackets. But that's another thing that you can usually prepare for, which is check the weather. What's the weather going to be like? And you get a better idea of, well, should I bring a heavier jacket or a lighter jacket or just a pullover, things like that. And it's just, I think it's pretty easy to do.
We call them drop bags, and we think about picking things up there, but drop bags are also for dropping things off, you know, where you're starting a morning run and instead of just enduring some of the cool, go ahead and throw on the extra stuff to make it a little more comfortable in the morning, and then drop that stuff off at that aid station with the drop bag. That's an option too.
Yeah, that's what saying that, like, make sure that you have some space so that you can get rid of those things, and maybe bring a few extra, but be very cautious with bringing the extra. Sometimes I'll bring a little extra nutrition if I think I'm going to be in a situation where I'm going to need it. And a lot of times I don't end up using it, but it's good peace of mind to know that it's there.
Have you ever had a runner, or you've been party to it, where you say the person may be behind you and you say, you know what? My drop bag is up there at that next aid station. Go ahead and get X out of it. Or I have that. So drop bags can be community if needed to try to help somebody out.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, sometimes I've run past somebody who did not look like they were doing too well. And fortunately, in those moments, like if I got anything extra on me that I can give them, knowing that, you know, okay, I'm okay if I give them three of my goose because I know I've got a couple of extras in my bag already. So I can just take care of them on the trail and then keep moving.
Boy, that is trail karma at its best there, Victor.
Yeah, I try. Aside from picking up the stray, you know, goo packages that fall out of people's pockets.
Yeah.
You know, I do my part. I try to do my part.
The rule is if you pick up empty, for every empty goo wrapper you pick up, you lose 1 minute per mile on that next hour.
I like that, Scott. I'm going to hold you to that.
Yeah.
We mentioned headlamps, and part of what Petzl has done is recruited some of the finest engineers from the universities around the globe. I may be exaggerating a bit, but they put together some pretty nice headlamps.
They do, and we've run with them, and I'll tell you, you may think that there's no difference, that headlamps are pretty much a commodity. They're not. Get yourself a good headlamp. That is one area. You invest in good shoes, you invest in a good headlamp, because a headlamp is going to outlast 20 pairs of shoes.
You know what? You're right, Scott. You know, I don't think I've worn out too many headlamps, but I've worn out plenty of shoes. I like that point. Invest in your headlamp now. And speaking of now, the NOA. How was that for a segue, Scott?
That was good.
That was lucky.
Good lead in.
Every blind squirrel gets a nut occasionally.
Thank you, Victor. Thank you, Victor, for your running strategy. You can check out his stuff, his bags at victorysportdesign.com. And you can check out Petzl headlamps at petzl.com.
Thanks, Victor.
Thanks, Don. Thanks, Scott.
Are we recording?
You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
I'm stretching my groin.
Whatever.
I feel vulnerable.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott Warr. And today, it's been a long time.
It's been too long, Scott. It's overdue.
It is way overdue. We have Dr. Mark Cucuzzella with us again.
Time to go see the trail doctor.
Dr. Mark, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Excellent. And we're extremely excited to talk to him today because we know that recently he has returned from the great continent of South Africa, where he ran Comrades.
Wow.
Which, you know, I didn't know that much about Comrades. Let me educate you a little bit, Don. For the rest of the world that
it is in the same place I am of needing to know.
Well, I think it's just probably the U.S.-based population of runners that don't know anything about Comrades, because this is the largest ultramarathon in the world. Largest, and it's the oldest. It started back in 1921, and over 300,000 runners have completed Comrades. It depends on the year. They reverse the course every year. One year it's an up year, one year it's a down year, and the mileage changes. It's anywhere from 87 to 89 kilometers. For those in the non-metric world, that's about 54 to 55 miles.
All right.
But this year, I didn't hear how many people started this year, but I know last year it was just under 20,000 people. Do you know how many started this year?
Yeah, I believe it was 20,000, or, you know, because that was the number they accepted and how many people lined up, not quite sure. But it looked like a lot of people, so I'll give it that, yeah.
Well, give me some perspective, and forgive me because I'm not a marathon runner. How many people start Boston? Is it close to 20,000?
20 to 25,000.
Okay, so it's comprehensible.
Yeah, it's in that amount. Yeah, it's just that mass of people that you don't see the back and you don't see the front. You're just in this big herd of people.
And do they start you in waves?
They have corrals. So based on, I had a marathon qualifying time, so I was in the A corral, which was mostly, you know, the local African runners, some international runners, and it goes back into like an HH corral. So it's just this mass of humanity, and it starts at like 5 in the morning, so it's pitch black. So you really don't have any idea how many people are out there. You just kind of show up, find your corral, and wait. So the gun goes off.
So you're in this corral. Is it a wide open start? Because I'm like Scott. Well, Scott was telling me about, you know, this event. But is it a place where you could get in a conga line where it becomes very difficult to either you're caught up with the group you shouldn't be, or you wish you were ahead and you're forced to run? Or is there a wide open start where there's plenty of real estate?
There's a lot of room. I mean, it's probably like a 4-lane road going out of Durban at least. I'm trying to think back, I was kind of in a daze. I'd gotten off the plane less than 24 hours before the start and somehow found my way there through the kindness of friend Zola Budd was my host, and she knows everyone there. She's an icon in South Africa and had some friends who had a house who had run the race 10 times, so I just kind of jumped in their car and followed along, and they took me to the start. But it's I think like any ultra, no one just races off on the start other than the front group, which is really amazing just that people actually race this thing after having experienced / survived it. You know, that there's actually a whole pack of people, international runners, world-class marathoners, and ultra-runners lining up to try to run this thing at close to 6 minutes a mile.
Wow.
7,000 feet of gain and 4,000 feet of loss, all on roads. So it's brutal just to run it.
What is the weather like during this race? Is it pretty hot?
Well, I mean, my N of one, you know, this is my only time I've run this thing, but it was by records, it was the hottest that they'd had in about 37 years.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was hot. And the people I'd stayed with had run like 10 of these things, and they said the conditions were about as severe as they'd experienced. I think about a third, so 20,000 were officially lined up to start, and a third did not finish. They're really strict about the cut points at this course. You know, you have to be at a certain time at each cut point, and if not, they close the course. So there's a pretty good attrition rate along the way, but less than two-thirds of the starters finish. So I'm not sure what the final finish number is. I think it was 12 or 13,000, but there's a lot of carnage out there along the way.
You know, the thing that there's some cool peculiarities or uniquenesses about this race, and I thought they were really cool. They have different medals. So if you finish, you know, in the top, there's a medal. Dr. Mark did extremely well. He finished under 8:30 for this 55-mile run, which gave him, if I get this right, the Bill Rowan medal. So they have, you know, they have a medal for the first 10 men and women. They have another one called the Willie Hayward Medal, which you have to finish in sub 6 hours. Then they have a silver medal, which you have to finish under 7.5. And then they have the one that Dr. Mark, and they have different medals. And then there is a time limit. You have to finish within 12 hours. And as I was doing some research on this, there's some really pretty motivational video clips of people that are just, you know, you've seen them at ultras that are just hammered. And there was one guy that was trying to make it across the finish line before the 12-hour mark. And he was crawling and just scraping and finally rolled across the finish line with like a second left. It was quite motivational. But go ahead.
I want to know something about the roads. So are we talking paved road, dirt roads, sandy roads? What are we talking about, Dr. Mark?
Yeah, it's all paved. So you're running between two towns, and they call it kind of the Valley of the Hills, where you leave out of Durban. So it was an up year this year. Mm. So you go out of Durban, which is at sea level, and you end in Peter Martinsburg. But the thing about the medals, you know, to go back to that, I think it was just really, I didn't know anything about these medals. But they're really, you know, in the U.S. now, it seems like people don't want to run a race unless they get this big, honking, massive medal or something that, okay, so you run a half marathon and you get this big Made in China thing that weighs about 5 pounds, and the bigger the medal, the better. But these medals are like the size of a quarter, and they're made out of like, it's almost like plastic. But people live and die for what metal they get. You know, not so much the value of the metal, but just the honor of running this race and achieving this time. And after running it, I get it. this year there are very few people actually to get to that silver medal because there's 20 to 30 mile an hour headwinds the whole way too. So most people reset their goals really quick once they got up into the hills. You know, their goal, just like me, I didn't have any time goal. I just wanted to get through this thing and, you know, wake up the next day. That was it. Just experience the day. But, yeah, it's just a totally different culture. So for the people there, the medal is actually running the race. And, you know, this token they get at the end, I think, is more of just a symbol of what they've achieved and accomplished through a year of training than anything else. I'd like to see things get back that way in the U.S. It seems like we've just kind of gone overboard with swag. And that's why I like trail runs is, you know, you show up and you don't even need a, you know, T-shirt or anything. Just show up and run and bring your own aid station with you and maybe get a little pint glass at the end. And, you know, that's how we use our run, Freedom's Run. We have a small medal, which is a medallion of John Brown's fort. You know, it doesn't weigh as much as, you know, your front wheel of your car. And we explain the significance of that medal and what that means. And as soon as you do that, people are pretty happy with what they got and the experience of being out on the course.
You know, so there's some other uniquenesses to this race. And one of them is, as I was reading, that they have a club called the Green Number Club. And you can become a member of this elite club if you can do one of three things. One of them, three wins, which is probably pretty hard to do.
Yeah, there's not a lot of that's a group that there's not many in.
The second way you can get in is if you have five gold medal finishes, which means you're pretty darn fast.
Yeah.
And under 6 hours. It's sick.
Yeah, under 6 hours. And then the third one is to have 10 medal finishes. And you think, well, yeah, that means you've been putting some miles in at Comrades. But then there's also a unique thing that I thought was very cool that I think many of these races should adopt, and that is if you have 25 finishes, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, if you have 25 finishes, you no longer have to pay a registration fee. Mm-hmm. It's free for the rest of your life, right? Did you know that, Mark?
I didn't know that, and the odds of me getting to 25.
Well, all you need is 10 more, is 9 more. You're a medal finisher. Yeah. You only need 9
more.
One
of the gentlemen I stayed with, his name was Yelton Murray, and he got his 10th finish, you know, this year, and it was amazing because I didn't know anything about this. So he finished the race, and he got kind of filtered off into this special area where he got his number. So it's actually a designated number that you pin on your shirt every year. So he left the race with his permanent number, which is like a cloth number that every year he runs the race, that's his number. And he was so proud of that, you know, man, he was, it's hard to describe that he finished his thing in like 11 hours. It was one of the most challenging things he'd done. But he got to that 10th one, and you know, he's not sure, you know, I think everyone has to kind of reconsider because it, you know, nearly kills you to do the 10th, and now he's got his number. I'm sure he's he's motivated to come back again because he's one of the few people that actually have one of these numbers now. But he'll be back next year, I bet. He just needs a couple nights sleep and a few beers, and he'll be back.
You know, I like that where you earn and have your own number, and perhaps as maybe they do it. But as I'm dreaming up this story, is that they retire that number when it's done. So if you're number 427, that's
they
it.
Retire it. That's it.
That number yours forever.
Yours forever. Cool.
And because this race has been going on since 1921, there are some people that have racked up some finishes. The record holders, there's a couple of them that have done like 45 finishes, 42 finishes.
Are you kidding me?
There's half a dozen that have done more than 40 finishes. You consider that. I mean,
with a 12-hour cutoff time, that really
40 finishes. Let's say you started, and you have to be 20 years old to start. Mm-hmm. That's one of the qualifications. Is you have to be a minimum of 20 years old. So that means they're doing this into their 60s every year until they're in their 60s, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is completely humbling to make it through one of these things, you're like, wow, so, that was the toughest thing I've ever done in my life. And then another gentleman who stayed with us had done 30, and he was, must have been 60 years old, but he's done 30 of these things. And just, so people have Boston Marathon streaks. That is a walk in the park compared to doing this thing 30 times. So I give the utmost respect for people that have done that. It's another league.
Well, you had the full Monte. You had uphill year, you had a heat year, and you also had a headwind coming at you. So there wasn't they didn't leave anything out to welcome you to their race, did they?
No, but I think that's all the encouragement to, come back next year. I'll have, additional incentive now. I have a downhill year, which is not easy, by the way. I think people kind of think, oh, downhill is good, but to run down 7,000 feet on the roads, I'll definitely need a little cushioning under my feet. Even as a barefoot runner, there'll need to be some protection there to run down those hills like that. But we'll see. I think, it's still a year off, and we had a great sports medicine conference. That was the main reason for going there, and the run was a side highlight. I think you don't belong in a running conference teaching about running in South Africa unless you've run Comrades. I felt somewhere I needed to go and experience the race just so I could, be one of the people that were in the audience there, who many of them had experienced this race. So I understood what they were experiencing and understood the people and the culture of South Africa.
We'd love to hear about that, what you learned at that sports medicine conference, but I have a couple more questions about Comrades, if I may ask. You've run JFK, and there's been a lot of people that have run that, especially on the East Coast, because it's what is the largest 50-mile run. Can you kind of give us a comparison of what you experienced there compared to this such difficult event in South Africa?
Yeah, they're two completely different events. They're really even hard to compare. So one is at 20,000, so Comrades, 20,000 people, massive event, million spectators along the route, kids, and just whole cultural event that everyone in South Africa knows about and follows. It's like the Super Bowl of South Africa. It was an event that gave opportunity to black South Africans in the apartheid days. This was their championship event. It was Alberto Salazar's last race. He won Comrades and then walked away. So just completely different. JFK is a true trail kind of race. I love JFK, but it's a small local event for culture and the people there who are running the race. It's national in caliber for the competitors, but as far as the regional and local impact, the runners come and watch it. But Comrades, everyone who lives in South Africa along that route is out watching the race. I can't imagine how many cookouts I passed. It's like the Tour de France, so mm-hmm. Tour de France is coming through your village. Everyone who lives near that village is out watching. So it is that kind of a spectacle. I think if you just Google any video on Comrades, you'll get an idea that it's like the Boston Marathon, but for 56 miles along this route. That's just people. It was hard to find a stretch where there weren't people along the way. And I'm talking 56 miles through these poor African villages. You had kids out there, thousands of them, and their bare feet handing out water sachets. Or, these little plastic things that, they didn't have cups. They were these little bags of water that you'd have to tear off the corner of your teeth. So they're giving you little potatoes and cuts of fruit and cookies and things. But I think you have to, if you're a runner, and an ultra runner especially, I think making the pilgrimage there to do this race at least once in your life is just something to experience. They treat the international runners really well, too. They have a whole separate international section because they really do want international runners to come. We had our own tent at the finish with food and beer and stuff. So it was, you feel taken care of, too.
There aren't that – I was just looking at the entry list, and there aren't that many international runners. Of the 20,000, only about 1,100 are international. The majority of them are from South Africa, but here's my question: Do you see that Comrades is a race that is more for marathoners? Are there more marathoners running comrades, or are there more ultra-marathoners running comrades?
You know, that's a great question. I think once you see it and experiencing it, these are ultra-runners. So, you know, I've run races in East Africa, West Africa, you know, run against the Kenyan. The group of South African runners who run this race, this is a different breed. These are strong runners. You know, if you lined them up in a mile race, I don't think, you know, they would be that fast. But this is their event. So these people train all year for comrades. This is it. This is the Super Bowl. And they're built like ultra runners. You know, they're not these, you know, really super lean, springy, gazelle kind of runners. They're muscular and they're strong. And, you know, most of them are probably from some village in South Africa. You know, culturally, they're, you know, the black South Africans, you know, who've fought out of poverty and, you know, have had a struggle. You know, so if you look at, you know, look at any picture from the start, and it's just, it's hard to pick out anyone other than a native South African in that group. You know, a few kind of specks in the crowd there, but that was one of those, and that's what I just embraced. You know, at the start, they sang this song. It's called Shuzaluza. It's this mining song that goes back generations, and they just start singing this song, and you're sitting in this crowd, and, you know, you just shivers go through your body as you're just waiting to start this race, and, you know, like 20,000 people are singing the song, which I'd heard, I think, somewhere along, you know, the line, but it's just like the rhythm of the group is, it was just nuts. Yeah, hard to describe, but yeah, you go there. If you're an ultra runner and you want to experience something different, you know, go and experience it, is all I can say.
Now we have kind of taught ourselves or learned through time and passed on to one another the way we apparently run ultras is to make sure that we have high fructose type of goos every, you know, 45 minutes and aid stations with Oreo cookies to potato chips to boiled potatoes to what have you. And we're carrying, you know, packs on our backs and 40 ounces of water. What can you tell us about how their culture or that race handles nutrition different than what we have, maybe corporate America has placed on our backs and in our hands over here in America?
Yes, I think the message I went into this race and certainly took away, you know, so there's no way anyone could be kind of neurotic about what they're going to eat and think they're going to get their own support. You know, there's 20,000 people and there's no roads, so you start the race and either you carry it or you get what's on the aid station. I chose to carry nothing. You know, that would have been a waste. I said, these people have done this race for 80 plus years, I guess. They, you know, I'll just do what my neighbor's doing and see what they're eating along the way. So, you know, they pretty much had everything out there. The delicacy on the course that has been there for years are these boiled potatoes that are soaked in salt. And I thought that was really good because you need the salt. It was really, really hot. I'm not a Pepsi drinker, but I was drinking quite a bit of Pepsi along the way just to get a little bit of sugar and a little caffeine, and that was good. They had some kind of electrolyte drink. They had fruit. Some stations had bananas. Some had oranges. There's some other food product that was about every 10 miles of some kind of a bar. I had no idea what it was. I think, like I was like most, is like if it's there and you're hungry, you eat it, and you weren't too picky or finicky. Now, probably the very front end of the race has their own support, you know, but that stuff was long gone by the time I came through. But I think everyone's pretty happy. The aid stations are very well stocked, and they're pretty frequent for an ultra. Usually ultra races, you know, every, you know, 10 miles you'd have an aid station or else you'd carry it. This was like a marathon where every couple miles there'd be another aid station, you know, with full support, you know, some calories, a lot of water. And I think most people were just taking mostly water and just dousing it over themselves to cool themselves because it was 90 plus, full African sun, you know, high noon. So your main goal was to cool yourself, you know, and keep hydrating, get a little bit of calorie in you. But it was adequate. I don't think having any plan, I think that would just mess you up. That you'd get kind of wigged out that your plan was going south because you couldn't get what you wanted, so you just take what you can get and be happy.
Did you have any kind of a crew that was following you along, or were you out there alone?
Oh, totally alone. I mean, it's it's impossible. It'd be like to get a crew because, again, it's one road that cuts through the countryside. You got 20,000 runners.
And shut down.
I think you'd have to have someone who really knows the South African countryside to crew for you. There's no way. You know, you start and you're obligated to finish because I have no idea how you'd get your way home. You know, I think everyone who runs ultras, at about halfway through, you're questioning, gosh, am I going to be able to make this thing? You start walking up the hill, and you do the math, and you're like, man, this is going to be a long walk. I better start running again. But you really don't have a plan B, so you got to get home. You're not going to pull off the road in the middle of Africa and hitchhike. So I think that kept me going. I knew there was another aid station every couple miles, and I'd find something to eat or drink to keep me going, and really the company of the people out there. I made so many friends and conversations, you know, with people. They kind of knew I wasn't from there. You know, they would ask me about America, and I killed a mile. You know, I'd ask them where they were from and tell me about their training and, you know, what they did for work or their families. And yeah, so that got me through several miles of uphills. I walked most of this. They have all these series. If you go to the course, there's series of these uphills, and they're named hills. And they go for a couple miles, so I decided to walk the uphills, the steep ones, and not even try to run them. So there were some nice walks where you'd get some nice chats with folks.
Is it difficult to qualify for this race? If somebody out there is listening to this and says, you know what, I really need to get out there and experience that, how tough is it to enter?
I don't know. My marathon time is pretty fast, so I don't think I had any trouble because I had a 2:40 marathon going in. But you have to go to the site. And
yeah, I actually looked
about in. About a three-hour marathon or a 50-miler, probably in the six-hour-ish range, you'd be a sure in. But international runners, they like international runners. So I think if you're an international runner and you send them a nice letter, if you do it early enough, they probably would let you in. But again, this race fills up. It's like Boston. Fills up really quick, and a lot of people want to run this race. So if you do want to do it, you know, get on the site and find out, like, get in day one when you can enter.
Yeah, I actually looked that up, and it's a five-hour marathon, so you don't have to be super
okay,
quick.
That's not bad.
Five-hour marathon, or for you ultra runners, you can do 100K under 13 and a half hours.
Yeah, you're in.
I like the way Dr. Mark says, yeah, and if you're running like a 6 hour 50, you shouldn't have any trouble at all. Dr. Mark, that's screaming fast, 6 hour 50.
Yeah, I didn't know. I mean, all I know is like when I wanted to sign up for this thing, you know, everyone's like, you better get in quick because it fills up. And so I got all my stuff in.
So I get the impression that you enjoyed it so much that you're signing up next year?
Yeah, I think if we do the Sports Med Conference, I'm game to go back. I think like anything, the first year you just want to learn it a little bit, and the next year you'd have a little more experience and go try to, you know, improve on what you did the first year, experience the culture again. I mean, everyone who is out there is like, you know, I think it's a given. They're like, if you do one, you have to, you know, you're kind of committed in some way. They're like, oh, you got to come back. You got to come back. So I think all of us are like that in spirit. You know, there's always unfinished business, you know, so I'll probably come back and do at least one more, at least to experience the downhill. And after that, we'll see. Take everything a year to
after
time.
After that, then you're going to have to go after that green club.
Yeah, then it'll be the green.
You know,
next goal is the silver medal, which is the 7:30. This year, that was out of the picture with the weather, but I think with a good year, you know, good weather, you know, get the 7:30 medal.
You speak about unfinished business, and I so relate to that because I'm not so sure I have any race that I don't have unfinished business with. You name any race, I think I have to go back and do a little work on it.
Oh, yeah. It's. I think that's why running is such a fun sport, because you have unfinished business within yourself. You know, there's something that you feel you want to improve on, or I think it's about learning. You know, it's about that, just that human adventurer, you know, that we all are. You know, I think George Sheehan described a lot of this when he gave talks about just the human organism, and, you know, we're basically like an animal. You know, you just want to go out there and go after it and achieve something that only matters to you, and that's what it is, you know.
What was the demographic female to male ratio? Were there a lot more males than females?
Definitely, and I think that's probably the African culture.
Okay,
is the opportunities and just the culture of females in Africa is not one of physical activity and opportunity in sport. That being said, I saw a lot of female runners. Did not see a lot of the black South African female runners, where I saw thousands of the native black South African runners. So maybe in 10 years, and that would be really neat to see, because you look at Ethiopia and Kenya, 20 years ago, you never saw their female runners out there because culturally they were not allowed to do sport. And now, gosh, Tirunesh Dibaba won last night in the 10,000 meters, blew everyone away. Edna Kiplagat won the marathon for Kenya. So they're changing Kenyan and Ethiopian culture. And I think South Africa, is a bit behind based on their history. But, gosh, what a delight it would be to show up in 10 years and the diversity of the race completely change. I saw a ton of really tough international female runners that are just built like ultra runners. They are so strong. And if it was a quarter mile, I'd dust them, but in the ultra, they're going by me like I'm standing still. they're ultra runners. They're just so strong. And it's why ultras are so different than the track events. I'm from a track and short distance background, but I embrace ultras because we all like to do something that is different, and maybe it's not our best thing or our forte, but that's how we learn, is jump into another game. Kind of Mo and Usain Bolt are going to line up at 600 meters, I think, and that'll be interesting. Both of them kind of going totally out of their game to go have some fun and learn something. They'll raise quite a bit of money for whatever they decide to raise money for. I think they're doing this for charity. Sell it to television, but that'll be really cool to see. But get out of that comfort zone, and I'll become, a better overall athlete and probably a better human being by getting out of the place I'm comfortable and just going out there and doing something you're going to get your butt kicked at.
Well, and that's a given when it comes to endurance events. There's something lurking around the corner, whether it's your own body or the course itself or a competitor, you name it, that's going to help teach a lesson for the day.
Oh yeah.
So speaking of lessons, you were there for a sports medicine conference. What can you bring from South Africa and share with us that we can help us become better runners?
Ashno, it was a privilege to go to this conference because Dr. Timothy Noakes has been on your show. Is that correct?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. He spoke about waterlogged.
Yes.
I listened to that. To that special. So Tim Noakes is the premier sports scientist on the planet. He's written more and challenged more during his career than anyone I know. And that's what makes science wonderful, because we always challenge conventional wisdom. That's science, is discovery. And there's always something new to discover. So just the opportunity to go teach a course with Tim, to me that's a career highlight as a physician. And as a medical practitioner and a scientist, that scientist meaning we're always challenging things and trying to discover new things. So I've read everything he's written through my whole life. I've got the lore of running, dug through all the references. And, what fascinated me about a year ago was I was working on an Air Force project, and I communicated with Tim by email about some of his new thoughts on things. If he were to train the entire Air Force, what are some principles that he'd want to, pass on, because through his experience, I've tapped into a lot of wisdom of people that are way smarter than me, who had way more experience, if I'm trying to do a program that reaches, 800,000 troops. The first thing being, train aerobically. This is not a high-intensity, interval type of system. You want to create healthy airmen, healthy soldiers first, and develop the aerobic system. You're training them for life, not for a mile and a half test. And that really fit in line with, I think, everything we've talked about on this show, Maffetone method, building aerobic base, all of that, all the health benefits of that. nutrition has been a huge interest of mine for the last 5 years. I've been real involved in pediatric obesity, community interventions, dealing with public health and obesity and nutrition. And Tim and I have been very aligned with, you know, the movement toward just, you know, real whole food movement, you know, with this whole paradigm, you know, that we've seen in medicine of teaching people to eat low fat and high carbs and tons of grains, you know, has all worked if you're an endurance athlete running 10 miles a day. But for the rest of the population, it's made them go south. It's made them obese, way too many carbs. And, you know, Tim actually had the guts to say, throw out the chapter in The Lore of Running that I wrote on nutrition. And he wrote that about 10 years ago because he's discovered in his own body and those of athletes of his generation that, you know, once you stopped running 100 miles a week, you couldn't eat like this anymore. So he gave a whole talk, you know, it's about a two-hour talk just about the whole history of nutrition and the whole science behind everything that we eat. And it was really confirming to a lot of things that I've come to discover here living in West Virginia, you know, where we see obesity, you know, we see the processed food and the sugars. But for the readers out there and the listeners out there, if there's one book, you know, every time you go to a conference and listen to someone, they, you know, it makes you pick up a book that you've never heard of. So the book that I got tuned into from Tim was a book called Nutrition and Human Degeneration by a gentleman named Weston Price. And Weston Price was a dentist in the 1930s. If we have a couple minutes, I'll share the story. Do you want me to go ahead and just kind of share?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's no limit to the hard drive space we have here.
Say the title of the book again.
Yeah, so Weston, and you could put on the link. So it's called Weston Price is the author, and it's called Nutrition and Human Degeneration. And it was published first in, I believe, 1939. But the story, and these are kind of buried works. You know, they're like, you know, some of these papers I have on our minimalist running site, like the 1905 Hoffman paper, you know, showing what a shoe does to a human's foot, you know, 1905, or the Munson paper about the military boots and the soldier's foot, 1912. I mean, there's absolutely nothing new we've discovered since those seminal papers. You know, they tell what it is. Now it's new and trendy, but this stuff was all figured out 100 years ago.
Wow.
So the story of Weston Price and nutrition was he's a dentist. He was a dentist in Cleveland, and he lost a son to a tooth infection. So he's scratching his head and saying, why are people getting tooth infections now? You know, in my grandparents' generation, no one got tooth infections. You know, no one. They didn't brush their teeth either. They had fine teeth. So he was a dentist. They wanted to figure that out. So what he decided to do was to go study the places on the globe that had no tooth decay. You know, so it brought him to all these indigenous untouched cultures all throughout the planet. You know, places that had no contact with modern society. And those are hard places to find now. But 1930, a few existed. And these were all over the globe. There were, you know, there's an island off of Ireland, you know, Swiss Alps. You know, the Incas down in the Mayans down in Peru. You had all kinds of tribes in Africa. You had the Cherokee, Samoa. Not the Mayans. There was this couple millennia ago, but the Incas that were living in South America, but there are about 12 different pockets of Aboriginal Australia and New Zealand that had no tooth decay. So he found all these places, and he traveled to these places. It took him 10 years, but what he quickly discovered when he visited these places was not only did they not have tooth decay, they had perfectly formed mouths, and they were perfectly healthy. That they had no modern diseases. You know, they didn't have any of this cardiovascular disease, diabetes. And this is 1930, and by standards today, these illnesses were actually pretty rare in 1930. But we were seeing this huge trend, even at that time, of people getting these new diseases, these affluent modern society diseases. So he went and studied what these people were doing, and he studied the nutrition. And the beauty of it is that it was very diverse, you know, so now you have everyone in their camp. You know, I'm a vegan or I'm a paleo, you know, I'm very rigid and everyone else is wrong. But what Price discovered in 1930 was it was all very traditional and culturally relevant and very depending on where you lived. So if you're in a place that didn't have a lot of plants, it was mostly kind of a seafood, meat-based diet, a lot of seeds and nuts and those things. And then there were cultures that had a lot of plants, that had much more of a plant-based diet. Some of the cultures had grains. You know, God forbid they ate some grains. But it was different than white Wonder Bread. So it's really diverse. So there's, you know, probably what we call epigenetics. So, I mean, these cultures probably did evolve to develop certain enzymes to eat in this way to extract the nutrients. But it was all real food, and he made the conclusion was as soon as modern processed stuff hit these places, the health went south, because he saw within a generation that these cultures started to get sick as soon as they moved out of that traditional way of living. So that, you know, that just confirmed for me, you know, I like to eat everything as long as it's good food. And I think as an athlete, you know, you do need, you know, some fats and protein. So, you know, what really disturbs me in a way is there's a whole camp of medical folks out there now that are really extreme in that, okay, all humans should eat just plants, period. You know, there's no eggs, no cheese, no butter, no fats, no meat, no seafood, just vegan-based diet. And, you know, the real science behind that is maybe if you're someone like Scott Jurek and you're really, really, really smart and you're a food scientist and you know how to combine your foods and you have 4 hours a day to prepare it all and shop at the best markets to get the best quality everything, you could do just fine. But I've got to go into West Virginia now and try to teach people to live healthy. And there's no way they're going to do that. They've got to go to the local market. So I have to figure out what is the healthiest message I can give to those people. You know, so it is just goes back to just eat real food and be diverse, get rid of all the processed stuff. But that book is a great read. Tons of pictures. The pictures say 1,000 words. When you see these impeccably well people, you know, that had no money, you know, they're from these little villages, but huge smiles, and not just free of disease, but we're talking the uber well, you know, the super well, you know, the super athletes, you know, the Maasai, the Samoa, the Cherokee. These were the uber people. They, you know, were the strongest people in the world, and they ate things that, you know, the modern wisdom will say, well, don't do that, that could kill you, but I don't think that's true. And I think history really, really tells us the truth. And then you go back and discover the science. So let's look at what works and let's figure it out. But the websites for Weston Price are great too. There's Weston Price Foundation, you know, so if you want to go onto it, you know, I've spent the last month digging into more of their information and actually sharing this with our medical school. We have a grant now for a teaching kitchen where we're trying to teach medical students nutrition and how to prepare food. And, you know, I think it's all about respecting tradition, science, and culture. It all kind of stopped there on the nutrition front, but that was one talk Tim gave, was about, you know, nutrition. He gave all these stories of athletes he'd worked with, Bruce Fordyce being one. So Bruce, you know, won 9 Comrades, which is crazy, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, he started to put on some weight, and he's been a, you know, colleague of Tim's for the years, and Tim got him on a better diet. And Bruce shed 30 pounds, and last year he ran close to 8 hours at Comrades. I think he's like 60 years old, which is just crazy fast.
Yeah.
You know, he had all these pictures of runners, you know, that just by switching, you know, to better nutrition, they improved everything.
I'd like to back up just for a second, if I may, on your comment about the demographics, where you're from, and how diet really ended up over time reflecting on what was available, which makes total sense, right? I mean, if you're out there where there's seafood, yeah, then your peoples will have for generations had eaten and digest. And
after you got to eat seals, you know, and your body will figure it out.
And so, should we look back, and it's harder now that we're not, you know, staying in one location, and we're so diverse, and parents from many different directions. Would it be advantageous to us to look back at our culture, at our ancestors, and say, perhaps this is the way I should be eating because my ancestors came from this region?
Exactly. That's why, have fun. I mean, I'm Italian origin and probably got some Irish in me. So if someone said I could never eat any pasta again because it was bad for me, I mean, I'd say, you're wrong. I'm sorry, I'll take my chances, because, you know, there's generations of people that ate the true Mediterranean diet, not the modern Mediterranean diet, which is Domino's. The true Mediterranean diet is You have salad, you have pasta as the first plate, you'd have some meat, you'd have cheeses, you drink your wine. I'm not going to change that. It's worked for years. You have olive oil, but it all came from, you know, probably within 5 miles of where you live. You know, you had your eggs, you know, right out of the field there with the chickens, and, you know, milked your own cows. But, I mean, that's the ideal. So I think you do the best you can. But if that's, you know, probably genetically I've evolved to, you know, eat the nutrients out of that type of diet. But you probably can make shifts as long as it's gradual. So if I did move to Asia, I'd probably, you know, start to eat a traditional diet that's probably very similar to Mediterranean, just has a little different ingredients. But respect your heritage. You know, we've seen, you know, I've worked in Native Alaska and horrible diabetes and disease states there that didn't exist 100 years ago, and we see that on the Indian reservations too. As soon as we brought our modern food into these areas that were very traditional, you know, the rates of diabetes on Indian and Eskimo reservations it's getting near 100% because they can't deal with these simple processed carbohydrates. Culturally, they've never eaten them, and it's toxic, the juice, the bread, the flour, the soda. All that stuff, it had no place on their plates.
Do you think over time that we could ever adapt, as the body is very adaptable? Could we adapt to this refined carbohydrate, you know, processed food? No.
No, because it's not food, you know, so that it never existed. So it's not food. So I don't think there's any way, and I'll put my life and license on it, there's no way we can adapt to something that's not real. It hasn't happened and it won't happen. And I think the day we're waiting for it to happen or some medicine's going to fix it all, it just won't happen. So do the best you can where you are. You know, shop around the perimeter of the store. It's not fancy or complicated. You know, we're not looking for specific nutrients of different vitamins or substances or fortified things. You know, foods mixed together to produce the right nutrients for our body when they're used in combination. You know, you mix things, then they taste good together, but there's probably a reason for that. You know, gosh, you put a little vinegar on some cucumbers and you mix it with some potatoes or something and somehow it just tastes a little better. You know, but there's probably something to that. Add a little salt to it, it tastes a little better. But, yeah, it's read Price's book, and I think take away from that and say, okay, how, you know, what are my roots, and what do I like, and where do I live, and what's available? And take a little time to prepare it because, you know, I think there are no real shortcuts. I mean, we're all looking for shortcuts, but, you know, your health is important, so you have to take a little extra time to prepare the things that are better for you than just picking it up and putting it in a bag and going home and, you know, taking it out of the bag.
So you had mentioned you went to this conference. You weren't there just as a participant. You were actually there presenting. Is that correct?
Yes. It's Dr. Noakes, Ian Adamson from Newton Running, and Zola Budd. We were all presenting different areas. I was mostly doing the biomechanics of running drills, aerobic development side, and then Zola added a lot of kind of the spiritual, mental perspective. Ian helped me a lot with the biomechanics side, did a lot of clinical assessments on runners. There were a number of physical therapists there, you know, injury evaluations. Tim's area, he talked a lot about the nutrition, hydration issues. He also gave a really nice talk on the central governor theory, and I know a lot of your listeners out there, you know, are familiar with the central governor theory, and he gave about an hour plus presentation on this, and, you know, just the marvels of the human brain and how the human brain drives performance is, I don't think we figured that one out yet either. He just had, you know, videos and stories and pictures of, you know, okay, well, why did one person win and the other didn't? You know, and the person that didn't wasn't dead, so there's something there. You know, and I'll share one story, which I just thought was a couple, which really good, but I think as listeners, they'll enjoy hearing these because maybe they haven't heard them. But so the 4-minute mile, so Tim knows every speck of history of running that probably exists. You know, he wrote the lore of running. spent years of his life digging in, interviewing everyone. So Laura Running, you know, he wrote that, but he interviewed Roger Bannister and Roger Bannister's coach. So Roger Bannister did not want to run that day. He's, you know, conditions aren't good, I'm not feeling good. And Stumpf was his coach. I forget his first name, but Stumpf was the last name of his coach. He said, Roger, I think you're ready to run a 356 today. I think you're ready to run 356. So Bannister's kind of sitting there and contemplating that and says, okay, I'll give it a go. You know, he runs 359.9 or whatever it is. You know, but he lined up thinking he could run 356. So he did 359. Now, whether his coach actually believed he could run 356 is another story. But he told him, you know, looked him in the eye and said, Roger, you can run 356 today. And certainly, you know, gosh, how many people broke 4 minutes in the 6 months after he did that? There were like four or five, maybe six people. I mean, they were breaking it like crazy. You know, Bannister said, well, après moi le deluge, you know, after me the deluge, which happened. So that was, then he also showed a real interesting slide in story two. And we'll never know the end of this one, but so the guy who was timing the 4 minute mile was Harold Abrams, the guy who was from Chariots of Fire, who won the gold medal, whatever year that was, 1920, in the 400 meters. So he was the official timer, and they had five timers. And so he showed a picture of the finish, and Harold Abrams was about 5 meters from the finish line, you know, in front of the finish line, you know, with his watch, you know, clicking it. And then there's the other timers were wherever. Then what happened was they finished the race, and all these timers get together, and then they announced the time. So there's kind of a little theory out there was maybe Harold clicked it. It was not quite. But that's, I think that's kind of one of the unknowns and the mysteries, but who cares? You know, he ran under 4 minutes that day, and I think he ran it again with John Landy about 2 weeks later, where they both broke 4 minutes and ran 3:58. So they broke that mental barrier. And then he talked about the day Dave Scott and Mark Allen were racing in 1989. That was the duel. That was probably the greatest head-to-head athletic duel ever. You know, these guys going 8 hours just side by side, not saying a word, until they got to 23 miles, and you know, Mark Allen takes off and wins the race. But they interviewed them both afterwards, and you know, interviewing Dave Scott, and Dave Scott saying, "Wow, he took off, and he was just too strong. He was just too strong." You know, Mark Allen runs away, and Mark Allen was talking about the day and talking about how he saw, you know, he'd been into shamanism, and somehow he looked up and saw the light, and he saw the shaman, and he got this energy, and he just took off. And yeah, so who knows what goes on as soon as, and I think we've all been there, as soon as we say in our mind, we're done, we're done. And as soon as you say, you know, I can go, you can go. You know, there's always another layer there that you can peel back. And he has all the science behind, you know, that the brain is really in charge of everything. And I think, you know, I listened to this talk after we did Comrades first, and then the conference was in Cape Town after the race. But I was playing that game with myself the whole time. You know, you're like, am I done? And then you just start running again, and for some reason you just get into a rhythm, and you feel good. You start to tell yourself, I feel good, I feel good, I feel good. And then you get some other hill, and it's like your brain starts telling you you're done again. Maybe get a little Coke or something and start running again, and then you're like, you're not done. Sure enough, you're like 2 miles from the finish, and you're running 7-minute pace again. You're like, what the heck, you know? 10 miles, 20 miles ago, I couldn't even shuffle at a 10-minute a mile. But I think I'll never figure it out, and I'm sure the listeners will never figure it out. So keep going out there and, you know, get your brain out of the way and just, you know, let your spirit take you.
Get your brain out of the way and get your run on. Yeah.
Yeah, we think too much, you know?
Yeah. Just get out there and run. And I know that that's one of the obstacles. May not be the heat of the day, it may not be the hill in front of you, but your own limit that you set on yourself, your own mind saying,
I am so done. And we've talked about this on the podcast, is you have to have a bigger why. Why I want to finish has to be bigger than every other obstacle that's thrown at you. And if your reason to finish and your goal to accomplish is bigger than anything that hits you, then you'll always be able to overcome. Now, there are times that it's smart to shut down. And if you have an aid station captain advisor, medical advisor that says you're done because you're at risk, then you need to be smart enough to say, I imagine that person can think better than I am right now because I can't even do simple math. If I can't do simple math, how can I expect to make a good rational decision? So you have to rely on smart people helping you along the way. But when it comes to just the self-pity party, the I'm so tired, I wish I was somewhere else, my feet hurt, or whatever else you can dream up of all the sensory info coming at you that you embellish and expand and create that's larger than it really is, you need to come back to that why, and you need to enter a race with a big why. You need to come to that party with a big why so that you can finish the day.
Yeah, again, you know, your point well taken about not going outside of the health box. What I don't like is when you have like a quarter mile from a marathon finish and you've got the announcer there that says, you know, come on, you can do it, you can suck it up, you can break 4 hours or something, because we see most cardiac events happen at the very end of the race, and they happen in men. They tend not to use their brain as wisely as females. I mean, I just witnessed that. You know, that's why maybe there's more deaths in endurance events in males. They shut off the wise part of the brain. You know, so I don't think we can fully define how the brain is in the way, but does protect us at times when we need it to protect us. So that's where I think experience and, you know, eating well. Let's go back to eating well so we don't have coronary disease. Because if you line up for a race and you've got coronary disease, you know, then you're on borrowed time. So line up for a race with normal coronary arteries by eating well and living well from the time you're 6 years old.
You know, these have been really good topics, Dr. Mark. And there is one other topic that we want to talk about, but we've run out of time. So we're going to do, I think, for the first time ever on Trail Runner Nation, a cliffhanger.
Oh, that's nice, Scott. Did you just come up with... We never really discussed in theory that we would have cliffhangers. So we're doing cliffhanger now?
We're doing a cliffhanger.
I like it.
And here is the cliffhanger for our next Dr. Kugazella podcast, and that is, Dr. Kugazella, where do you think minimalist running is going?
Huh.
So what is the trend for minimalist running? But we don't want you to answer that.
Oh, yeah. We'll have a whole talk on that.
I think that's the topic for our next discussion with Dr. Mark. We're extremely happy that you had the time to sit down with us. We always enjoyed talking to you. I learned a lot about Comrades. I was surprised. It is the oldest and largest ultramarathon in the world.
By far.
Yeah. It's actually very interesting. They have a stat page on there that shows you how many bananas, how many bottles of water, how many volunteers they have. And it's, you know, we think that Western States has a lot. This dwarfs it.
We have 380 runners. Come on.
380 runners. This has 20,000 runners. But we've really enjoyed it. We appreciate your time.
You know, one quick plug, there's a, for the Ultra crew out there, so Freedom's Run, which is our local race in West Virginia, Joel Wolpert and Anton Krupichka put together a beautiful movie called In the High Country, and maybe some of y'all have seen the trailers, but Anton and Joel are going to come to Freedom's Run on October 11th for a local showing at our old opera house where you could meet Anton, watch the movie of Anton and Joel running through the mountains all over the West. I believe they travel around to some places in other countries too, just scaling peaks, and then you can run the marathon. But just having Anton and Joel come, you know, to give a community talk and on their world premiere tour will be really cool. So you can find information on that. We're going to have it posted on freedomsrun.org. But a really nice opportunity if you're in the region to, you know, meet Anton and come to a nice run that isn't an ultra but does have that feel. It's only 26 miles, but you could do half marathon too. Bring your kids to the 5K, 10K, or kids run.
What's the date on that, Dr. Mark, if people are interested?
October 12th, and the event with Anton and Joel will be October 11th, the night before the race.
Well, we'll link that to the podcast, and I'll tell you, we've met Tony, and the guy is
he's a trail runner,
and he's a trail runner. He's very approachable, very humble. I think that he takes his fame very almost embarrassed about it, that people want to talk to him. But he's just a really cool guy.
Yeah. Yep. He's like any trail runner you meet, and whether he's in the front, middle, or back, he's by family, part of the trail community.
Yep.
And that's the neat thing.
What we all wish we could be would be just wake up and run trails all day and not just sit at a desk.
Yeah, that's right.
All this doesn't matter about speed. It's just that life. We all would want that life.
Yeah. It doesn't matter how fast you go. It doesn't matter how fast you go out there. You know, everybody is just run comfortably. Run so that you can run the next day. If you're, I'm gonna put this out there, and you can correct me because you're our doctor of the trail. If your trail running is creating an issue where the next day you're having trouble getting out there and just moving around, then you need to back off a little bit and change your intensity. We should be able to run so that we're healthy the next day too, and not nursing ourselves.
Exactly.
What did you used to say, Dr. Mark?
Yeah, exactly. That's why you take your shoes off every now and then, because it forces you to recover.
Dr. Mark used to say, or do still say, but on a previous podcast, train, don't strain.
I didn't. Lydiard said that.
Oh, well, I gave it to you, you know, the next generation.
I know. Yeah, wiser people than me. Bowerman has that all over the book Jogging, 1967, because Bowerman learned everything from Lydiard. But like every page, train, don't strain.
Well, you know, everybody looks to the person that shared it with them, and that's what the trail community is about, passing it on and learning from communication.
Well, we appreciate your time.
It's always a pleasure and privilege being on the show, and got such a great following on Trail Runner Nation. Glad to be part of the crew.
So, Dr. Mark, your website is naturalrunningcenter.com.
Two Rivers Treads.
And TwoRiversTread.com,
which is the store, a place to go to find footwear, to get consults with people that are there at the store. You can call in and get some information, ask some questions to trained and knowledgeable shoe associates. I just made that term up.
And you can Skype them.
Yeah,
which is what Faith did. She got on there, Skyped them, and got some recommendations, and I think she's a Newton lover.
She does. She's been wearing her Newtons. And Dr. Mark, I don't know how many people I have told about that 8-minute and 24-second YouTube video.
Yep.
I'm responsible for some of those downloads myself, and by association. You've got to link that, Scott, because you can't watch that enough. That video will teach you something every time you look at it, a little bit more about what you should and shouldn't do as a runner. It makes a big, big difference. So we appreciate that. Now, Trail Runner Nation, go to our website, trailrunnernation.com. I'm going to pull this off myself, Scott. Go to Twitter at We Are Nation, and go to Facebook. Look us up. We're there somewhere. So now go out and run.
Moss.
I was walking down the street when out the corner of my eye I saw a pretty little thing approaching me. She said, I never seen a man who looks so all alone. Could you use a little company? If you pay the right price, your evening will be nice, and you can go and send me on my way. I said, you're such a sweet young thing, why you do this to yourself? She looked at me, and this is what she said. Oh, there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. I got bills to pay, I got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know I can't slow down, I can't hold back, though you know I wish I could. Oh, no, there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.